Thomas Oden has written a book called Agenda for Theology, After Modernity, What? He wrote this many years ago. This is the revised version, but in it, he accurately captures the heart of modernity. He writes this: "The philosophical center of modernity is no dark secret. It is a narcissistic hedonism that assumes that moral value is reducible to now feelings, to sensory experience, and what you see, taste, touch. It views human existence essentially as a spiritless body, sex as orgasm, psychology as amoral data gathering, and politics is the manipulation of power. It systematically ignores the human capacity for self-transcendence, moral reasoning, covenant commitment, and self-sacrificial agape. It is a time that's just like the time of the judges that we went through." And this idea of modernity, this idea of this self-love, self-propelled, sensory-filled life that is directed by pleasure, was perhaps best described by Oscar Wilde in the only novel that he writ, The Picture of Dorian Gray. The main character of this book, Dorian, was most likely created after Oscar himself, after the life that he lived, a hedonistic lifestyle. And in this story, Dorian, for those of you who aren't familiar with this one, Dorian is a beautiful youth. And somehow, magically, he's had a picture painted of himself. And he discovers that as he begins following down this path of hedonism, the picture becomes affected, but he is not affected. He basically can get away with whatever he wants to and remain beautiful and young forever. And as you follow Dorian or Oscar Wilde in this story, there are two characters influencing him. One's basically the devil and one's basically his conscience. And in the passage I want to read to you today, Dorian has found himself in a troubling situation. He's been pursuing this young lady. He intended to marry her. She was an actress, and she was phenomenal. And he was encapsulated with this young lady. So he wanted to bring all his friends and introduce him to this young love that he intended to marry and show them how great she was. Well, she returned his feelings of affection, but because she has now finally experienced love for the first time, her desire to fake it in the theater had left her. She could no longer put on a show, so she became a terrible actress. And Dorian was mortified and embarrassed when his friends came and saw that she wasn't as good as he thought she was. So he immediately breaks off the engagement with her and leaves. That night, she kills herself. And Dorian finds out the next morning, and Harry, the devil character, approaches Dorian, and they're discussing what had just happened. He says, "It's Harry," cried Dorian Gray, coming over and sitting down beside him. "Why is it that I cannot feel this tragedy as much as I want to? I don't think I'm heartless, do you? You've done too many foolish things during the last fortnight to be entitled to give yourself that name, Dorian," answered Lord Henry with his sweet, melancholy smile. The lad frowned. "I don't like that explanation, Harry," he rejoined. "But I am glad that you don't think I'm heartless. I'm nothing of the kind. I know I'm not. And yet, I must admit that this thing that has happened does not affect me as it should. It seems to me to be simply like a wonderful ending to a wonderful play. It's had all the terrible beauty of a Greek tragedy. A tragedy in which I took a great part, but by which I have not been wounded." Dorian had spent his life walking farther and farther down the road away from his conscience call to the degree where he was no longer sensitive to it. It no longer affected him. It's the same situation that we've seen developing in Israel throughout the period of the judges. They're going farther and farther away from God's law where they're not even able to feel the distance. They don't recognize when they're disobeying the Lord. They don't know anymore. Last week, whenever the curtain fell on the book of Judges, well, the judges were doing what was right in their eyes. The people had Sodom and Gomorrah going on in the land. The priests were pagans that were inciting civil war. and the cities of Israel were going up in smoke. After the curtain falls, as far as the biblical story goes, we have a small interlude. We talked about that interlude a few weeks ago. It's called the Book of Ruth. After this terrible scene in the Book of Judges, this little woman walks out, and we watch this story of how two people are faithful amidst this time of faithlessness in Israel. One is a Gentile, and we watch how God is sovereignly working through his providential plan to still bring the seed of the woman into the world, the Messiah who will save and rule Israel and remove the curse, deliver the earth from sin, from Satan, from rebellion. He's still working that up. It picks up the pieces from where the genealogy was tracking all the way back in Genesis, and it's going to connect us to the book of Samuel. So we see that, we recognize, okay, the messianic hope, there it is. Ruth walks off the stage, and the last name, the last word in that book sounds off like a cannon. David. David. And of course, anyone reading this knows who David is. So he's the king. I'm expecting the king to come. Okay, we're here. Israel's going to have the king. It's the last thing Israel needs to represent and rule in the land, representing God's desires over the nations. There was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. Oh, here the king comes. The Lord has a plan. He's fixing the problem. When the curtain comes up, by the time we get to 1 Samuel, the spotlight appears on a little woman named Hannah. Now, Hannah is married to a man named Elkanah, and they live in the hill country of Ephraim. You remember the hill country of Ephraim? That's where Micah lived, where he had his house that he had kind of a pagan priesthood going on in. That's where the other Levite lived who started the civil war because of his concubine and how she was treated by the Benjamites and almost wiped out the Benjamites, and they destroyed Gibeah. In the same hill country, that's where they live. And we find out that there's a problem. You see, Hannah is barren. She cannot have children. In fact, the text tells us that it's of the Lord. In verse 5 and 6, it says twice, the Lord has closed her womb. Okay, so this is either because there's a Deuteronomy 28 curses going on the people. The Lord is enacting his curse, which doesn't surprise us. It is the same time period as the judges. Or it's a testing. Either way, Hannah is not able to conceive. Verse 3 tells us of a few individuals that are ruling during this time. Their names are Eli, Hophni, and Phinehas. They are priests. They are priests operating, ruling. Eli would be the high priest. These are his sons. They are ruling over Israel. Now, contextually, how should we feel about these priests just coming out of Judges? They probably okay? No, these guys are probably pagan. We don't have any expectations from them. And there's obviously, or most likely, curses going on in the land, so they're not doing their job. Now, when we look at Hannah and we look at her situation, we also find out that this individual, Elkanah, has taken a second wife. Now, we know that's a problem, right? The God's stamp of approval is not on polygamy in the Bible. It always causes issues. But here we see that Elkanah has decided to take a second wife, and this second wife, Peninnah, she has children. Lots of children. But Hannah, verse 2 says, Hannah had none. Now, what's going on here? Why would he take a second wife? Because his first wife is barren. See, Elkanah is trying to get around the curse. He's saying, the curse is here. I can't have a wife. I can't have children. I can't have seed. My wife is barren. So I need to obtain seed through another woman, a second wife. Does that sound familiar? Who do we know in the story that has done this? Abraham. It's Abraham. So if Elkanah is Abraham, who does that make Sarah? I mean, yeah. Womp womp. Yeah, Hannah is Sarah in this story. So he's taking a second wife. Now, how did it work out for Abraham? Not really well, right? Genesis chapter 16, the first three verses. Sarah comes to Abraham. She offers him Hagar so that through Hagar he can obtain seed. Verse 4, right after that, as soon as Hagar conceives, what happens? Sarah is despised in her sight. See, every single time you have multiple wives in the Bible, there is rivalry. We are competing for our husband's affection. And of course, children are a sign of blessing, right? The Lord must favor me. Oh, Sarah, all these years you haven't been able to bear children. The problem's obviously not Abraham, it's you. And much the same here with Hannah and Peninnah. Obviously, the problem is Hannah, because her husband can bear children, right? So, of course, there's rivalry. And as Elkanah takes his wives to Shiloh, where they're going, where the tabernacle is, they're going yearly to offer feasts, this is an opportunity for the rival wife to persecute. She persecutes Hannah. She makes fun of her. She degrades her because she hasn't been able to have children, just like Hagar. Look at verse 10. Now, Hannah, because she's been treated this way, she is greatly distressed. She takes her issue to the Lord one of these years. She's greatly distressed. She prays to the Lord. She's weeping bitterly. She makes a vow. And she says, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me and not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and a razor shall never come upon his head. Now this is starting to sound familiar too, right? You can just hear these stories ringing in your ears. Who does this sound like? Samson's mother, right? So not only is Hannah being compared to Sarah, she is being contrasted, literally, with Samson's mother. Because remember, Samson's mother did not care that she didn't have a child, or at least she wasn't approaching the Lord about it. And then when the Lord appeared to her and said, you are going to have a child, well, she was excited that she was going to have a child. She wasn't really interested in dedicating him to the Lord or what the Lord intended to do with him. She was just excited she was going to have one. But here we have Hannah who is approaching the Lord. She desires seed. She desires the blessing of the Lord, children. And she is making a vow, dangerous, of course, if you don't keep it. But she's making a vow to dedicate him to the Lord and that he will be a Nazarite from his womb. He will not shave his head. Now, Eli, the high priest, is sitting at the door of the tabernacle at this time. And he sees this woman weeping. And he sees her mouth moving. She's not praying out loud. She's inaudibly going before the Lord. And the conclusion that he makes is that she's drunk. He's saying, it is more likely, I'm deducing by my reason, that it's more likely that a person is coming to the tabernacle and is drunk than is praying. What in the world is going on? It's the time of the judges. The current state of Israel and the current state of the priesthood is in trouble. So Eli rebukes her. He says, woman, it's a light rebuke, but nonetheless, I mean, you would think at the tabernacle, this is serious business. You're coming to where the Lord's presence is and you are drunk. But Eli, you know, put away the drink from you. How long are you going to keep doing this? Look at Hannah's response. Verse 15, Hannah replied, no, my Lord, I am a woman oppressed in spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I've poured out my soul before the Lord. Do not consider your maidservant as a worthless woman, for I have spoken until now of my great concern and provocation. Verse 16, I don't know what your text says. It may say worthless woman. Literally, it is a daughter of Belial. Do not consider your maidservant a daughter of Belial. What is the daughter of Belial? It's a term that Paul picks up in 2 Corinthians. I'll read it. You don't have to turn there because you'll recognize the verse as soon as I do. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 14 and 15. Do not be bound together with unbelievers. For what partnerships has righteousness and lawlessness? Or what fellowship has light with darkness? Or what harmony has Christ with Belial? Or what has a believer in common with an unbeliever? Translation. There are two teams. There is God's team. There is Satan's team. There are the good guys. There are the bad guys. There's the seed of the woman. There is the seed of the serpent. There are those who follow revelation. There are those who do what's right in their own eyes. Human wisdom. Top line, bottom line. So, in case we haven't figured it out by this point, Hannah is just flat out telling Eli, look, I'm not on Satan's team. I denounce the seed of the serpent. I'm not a daughter of Belial. I'm with the seed of the woman. And Eli, in hearing this, he blesses her. He's pleasantly surprised. Haven't seen one of you guys around in a while. May the Lord give you all that you've asked. And she leaves. And her countenance, of course, is lifted. Because Eli is the high priest. He can basically speak prophecy to you. So this is good news for her. So she leaves, and of course, she conceives. She has a son. She names him Samuel. In the course of time, after she's weaned him at a very young age, she fulfills her vow to the Lord. She takes Samuel. She dedicates him to the temple, just as she had promised the Lord. Look at what Hannah does. After she dedicates him to the temple, look at chapter 2, she gives us her philosophy. Now, let's just go ahead and make sure we recognize this. What team is she on in this story? Right, she's seed of the woman. Okay, so when she gives her speech, her prayer, she is giving her philosophy. Now, if it's her philosophy and she's on God's team, whose philosophy is it? It's God's. It's like you might remember Eve. Okay, Eve is not on the serpent's team. She's on God's team. So when Eve is speaking, it's God's philosophy. They're sharing in the same desires. Look at her prayer. This is chapter 2, verses 1 through 10. Hannah prayed and said, "My heart exults in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. My mouth speaks boldly against my enemies." Who are Hannah's enemies? Now we would think, okay, literarily we recognize Peninnah is playing the role of the seed of the serpent, right? But Hannah, as seed of the woman, following God's revelation, playing on the side of the hero, her enemies are God's enemies. Her desires are God's desires. My mouth speaks boldly against my enemies, who are the enemies of the Lord, because I rejoice in your salvation, your deliverance. What kind of deliverance are we talking about? Is Israel currently in captivity? They are not. They are ruling in their land. So it's not talking about a Gentile oppressor. Now, what is this story about? What do we need deliverance from? We need deliverance from the curse. We need deliverance from death. We need deliverance from Satan. Hannah, who speaks against her enemies, which are the Lord's enemies, she rejoices in God's salvation from this enemy, the curse, the evil one. There is no one holy, verse 2, like the Lord. Indeed, there is no one besides you, nor is there any rock like our God. That's Deuteronomy 32 talk. Or Christ, upon this rock, me, I will build my church. This is Deuteronomy 32. This is Exodus. Remember the rock that followed them. Boast no more, verse 3, so very proudly. Do not let arrogance come out of your mouth. For the Lord is a God of knowledge, and with him actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty are shattered, but the feeble gird on strength. Those who were full hire themselves out for bread, but those who were hungry cease to hunger. Even the barren gives birth to seven, but she who has many children languishes. What is this talking about? The hungry cease to hunger? Is it simply physical prosperity? It's going to start to sound kind of like this song we were singing this morning, real quick. Verse 6. The Lord kills and makes alive. He brings down to Sheol, the grave, or possibly the netherworld, the world of the dead. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. What is that talking about? He kills and makes alive. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. What do we think that might mean? Resurrection? You mean to tell me there's resurrection in the Old Testament? Of course there is. This isn't a made-up new hope in the New Testament period. Hannah's hope is in resurrection. Now, Daniel 12, that our resurrection verse, is a long time from now. She knows about resurrection. In fact, when Jesus is approached with the Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection, and they ask him that silly question about marrying this girl married seven husbands. They all died. Who's is she going to be in the resurrection? He says, well, you don't know about the scriptures. You don't know what you're talking about. He goes back to Exodus to prove his point. He talks about the burning bush. I'm the God of Abraham, God of Isaac. He's not the God of the dead, but the living. He's not talking about them being living right now in heaven. He's not saying they don't cease to exist. He's talking about resurrection. This is context. He's talking to them about resurrection, saying that verse proves resurrection. The hope is already there because they have to be resurrected to receive the promise. They all died without receiving the promise. Everyone died without receiving the promise. Joseph died and said, please take my bones with you when you get into the land, because Joseph wants to be resurrected in the land. The hope of the Bible is resurrection, physical, bodily resurrection. And that is Hannah's hope. She seems to think that resurrection is part of this gospel that she's about to start laying out. It continues on. The Lord makes poor and rich. Verse 7, he brings low. He also exalts. He raises the poor from the dust. He lifts the needy from the garbage bin to make them sit with nobles and inherit a seat of honor. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and he set the world on them. Listen to this. He keeps the feet of his godly ones. The word there is the kesedim, those who receive God's sacrificial mercy as well as dispense God's sacrificial mercy. Godly ones, the kesedim. But the wicked ones are silenced in darkness. We're talking about the eschatological hope. This is what we're looking for at the end. For not by might shall a man prevail. Those who contend with the Lord shall be shattered. Against them he will thunder in the heavens. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king. He will exalt the horn of his anointed. The word is Messiah. He will exalt the horn of his Messiah. If that's not the explicit gospel message in the Old Testament, I don't know what is. Salvation, deliverance, with resurrection through faith and hope in God's king, his Messiah. From Hannah in 1 Samuel. She makes this prayer and she's going to step away from the scene now for a little bit. She's played her part. The camera watches her. She goes, where is the camera expected to go from here? We've been following this story. Where should we be looking now? Samuel, right? You watch one person until they've played their part, they fulfilled their role. We've been tracking this seed. Now we're tracking Hannah. She has a son. She dedicates him to the temple. She leaves. Samuel, what are you going to do, Samuel? What are you going to do? Look at verses 11 and 12. Elkanah went to his home at Ramah. The boy ministered to the Lord before Eli the priest. Now verse 12. The sons of Eli were, the word is sons of Belial. They did not know the Lord. So Hannah says, I'm not a seed of the serpent. I'm not on Satan's team. Now we have Samuel, who is ministering at the tabernacle with the priests, and the priests are on Satan's team. Satan's team is ministering in the tabernacle. I talked with someone actually earlier this week who was asking me a question about the situation. You have churches that have pastors or individuals that are working and serving who are, well, they're seeds of the serpent. Satan can operate in a church. He can do it here and he can do it there. You know, in fact, you think the upper room. You know, we think about the joy of being in the upper room, listening to the Lord speak to his disciples. You know who else was in the upper room?
Judas
and Satan. Because when the Lord passed the bread to Judas, Satan entered him. Satan is hanging out in the upper room. He's not a friend of believers, but he's happy to hang around you, to influence you, to drive you in a direction that will hurt your witness. That's one thing we have to recognize. When we're following this story, and a lot of interpreters have trouble with this, we're tracking two sides. We're tracking seed of the woman. We're tracking seed of the serpent. And that's going to help us sort the characters as we go. But it's helping us track the story. We're not tracking the salvation of these individuals. They are presenting themselves, they're operating, sometimes they're going to switch teams, especially in 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel. It's actually one book, and we're going to see it happen quite a few times in this book. You'll have one person who's on one team. He might be the Messiah instead. He's like standing in the place of Messiah. Next thing you know, he's on Satan's team. He's serving Satan through his actions. You can be a believer and be serving Satan. And we'll see that happen in this book. It's not tracking to salvation. It's helping us to follow the story about how God is working out his Messiah. Sometimes you act like a seed of the serpent. When you start doing what's right in your own eyes and you present your members to be useful as instruments of wickedness. If you start understanding top line and bottom line, as God presents it in the story is going to be simple. Life around you is going to be simple. And yourself is going to be simple. You're going to understand yourself a lot better. You say, I see what he's doing there. But when you look in the mirror, you say, I see what you're doing there. You're operating on your own wisdom. You're magnifying yourself. You knew that was wrong. And then when somebody came and they convicted you, your wife or your brother who loves you in the Lord and says, that's sin. And what'd you do? Well, you ran out and started persecuting them. You went out and started persecuting them. It's because it's not a salvific issue. We're talking about, we're following a story and we all have that old character, and you can very easily slip into using that old character. Now here we're tracking and we got our set. Samuel is going to be contrasted with the sons of Eli. That's how the author of this book is wanting you to track this story. Look at let's just start with the end of verse 12. The sons of Eli, they're seeds of the serpent. They don't know the Lord, and they don't know the custom of the priests with the people. Do they not know who Yahweh is, and they're a priest? They know Yahweh, right? They know his name. They intellectually, I know who he is. I know these priestly acts I'm supposed to be performing. I don't regard him as God. I don't have a relationship with him, and I don't fear him or fear his law. Right? I don't have a relationship with him, but they intellectually, propositionally know. They just don't have a relationship with God because they're seeds of the serpent here. Now notice what they do. Verse 13. When any man was offering a sacrifice, the priest's servant would come while the meat was boiling with a three-pronged fork in his hand. And he would thrust it into the pan, into the kettle. And he would, whatever he would draw out, he would take for himself. Thus they did in Shiloh to all the Israelites who came there. Also, before they burn the fat, the priest's servant would come and say to the man who was sacrificing, give the priest meat for roasting. He won't take boiled meat from you, only raw. If the man said to him, they must surely burn the fat first and then take as much as you desire, he would say, no, you shall give it to me now, and if not, I'll take it by force. Okay. They're eating the fat of the sacrifice. Now, how bad is that? What kind? What, on a scale of 1 to 10, what kind of sin are we thinking? It's pretty bad. Listen to this. I'll read it for you. Leviticus 3, verse 16 and 17. We'll cover this little sin. The priest shall offer up and smoke on the altar as food an offering by fire for a soothing aroma. All fat is the Lord's. It is a perpetual statute throughout your generations, in all your dwellings, you shall not eat any fat or any blood. Listen to chapter 7, verse 25. Any person who eats any blood? No, verse 25. Whoever eats the fat of an animal from which an offering by fire is offered to the Lord, even the person who eats shall be cut off from his people. It is a death sin. You are cut off. And there is no sacrifice that can atone for this sin. You're done. So they've committed at least one death sin, but they're not finished. Look at verse 22. Eli, when he's old, he hears of what his sons are doing in all of Israel, how they lay with the women who served at the doorway of the tent of meeting. They are fornicating. They're doing pagan rituals with the women at the tabernacle. And it's adultery. Phinehas, we find out in verse 4, is married. So another death judgment. But that's not all. It's not surprising to us with these things they're doing that God is desiring to put them to death. But the question is, who is supposed to carry out judgment on them? Whose responsibility is this?
Eli.
He's the high priest. He's the judge of Israel. He's supposed to deal with his sons. Now look what Eli does and said, verse 23 of chapter 2. Eli says to Hophni and Phinehas, "Why do you do such things? The evil things that I hear from all these people. No, my sons, for the report is not good which I hear the Lord's people circulating. If one man sins against another, God will mediate for him. But if a man sins against the Lord, who can intercede for him?" But they would not listen to the voice of their father, a third death sin, rebellion against not just their father, but the high priest, for the Lord desired to put them to death. Eli should be judging them, a death judgment, but instead he is lightly scolding them. This tells us what about Eli? He's a partial judge. He is not a righteous judge. Eli is not doing his job, and therefore not only do Eli's sons deserve judgment, Eli deserves judgment. But there's a problem. Eli's the judge of Israel. He's the priest, the high priest. Who can judge the ruler in Israel? Only God can judge the ruler in Israel. So who does God send to speak for him when the ruler in Israel is in trouble? Well, that's when the prophets start showing up. And we're going to start seeing a lot of these guys as the story continues. The prophet shows up and he comes out and he's going to tell, "Thus says the Lord." He speaks for the Lord. He doesn't speak on his own initiative. He doesn't speak in hazy, unclear sayings. He says, "The Lord says this, you better know it." The prophet shows up in verse 27, and he's going to let Eli know. Just look at verse 29. The Lord is saying, "Why do you kick at my sacrifice, Eli? Why do you kick at my offering, which I've commanded in my dwelling? And honor your sons above me by making yourselves fat with the choices of every offering of my people." By not disciplining his children, he is honoring his children more than the Lord. I hope that's not something we hear. Because he is sharing in accountability. It is a corporate sin. Look at verse 30. "Therefore the Lord, the God of Israel, declares, I did indeed say that your house and the house of your father should walk before me forever. But now the Lord declares, far be it from me. For those who honor me, I will honor. And those who despise me will be lightly esteemed. The days are coming when I will break your strength and the strength of your father's house, so that there will not be an old man in your house." And this prophet gives the first telling of this prophecy, verse 34, "The sign that you'll know, which is coming concerning your two sons, will be that Hophni and Phinehas, on the same day, both of them will die." We're looking at this point for the death of the two of them. We're watching Samuel, where he's contrasted with these two sons. They're going to receive the judgment. And in the midst of this declaration of judgment, God gives a promise. It's a new promise, new revelation. But, 35, "I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who will do according to what is in my heart and in my soul. And I will build him an enduring house, and he will walk before my anointed always." So after Deuteronomy 18, we're looking for the greater prophet, greater than Moses. Now we're looking for the greater priest, the one who will walk always before the Lord's anointed. And when we come to chapter 3, verse 1, the author turns back. "Now the boy Samuel was ministering before the Lord, before Eli." And the question in the reader's mind is this the one? He's just proclaimed there's going to be a new priesthood with a greater priest who won't be disobedient. He'll judge in righteousness. Is it Samuel? So we watch him. And as we watch, Samuel's ministering before Eli. The word of the Lord, of course, it's rare in those days. The people are in utter disobedience, so the Lord is not speaking to them. And it happened at that time, verse 2, as Eli was lying down in his place, notice this little aside, his eyesight had begun to grow dim and he could not see well. Why is that included? What have we learned about eyesight and the way eyesight works in this story? When we think of Isaac, I think of Samson, now we have Eli. Normally they're doing what's right in their own eyes until their eyes get put out, and then suddenly they're doing what the Lord wants them to do. Here we have Eli, His eyes are dim. He is losing his sight. It seems to be a critique on his priesthood. He is partially blind, just like in his judgment. Okay, he's not Samson over here. He still knows who the Lord is, but he's not judging correctly. He's going blind. Verse 3, Samuel's laying down in the temple of the Lord. He's laying where the ark was. And the Lord calls to Samuel. Samuel says, "Here I am." And he runs out to Eli. He says, "Here I am, for you called me." But Eli says, "I did not call. Go lie down." So Samuel went and laid down again. This happens 3 times. Samuel lays down. The Lord calls to him. He runs to Eli. "Here I am." Eli says, "I didn't call you. Go back." But by the 3rd time, we're told that Eli discerned that the Lord was calling the boy. Eli is familiar with what's going on. Perhaps he's had his experience. He is the high priest. He tells him, "Go back, lie down, listen to what the Lord has to say." And he does. And the Lord appears once again to Samuel and reveals his judgment upon Eli. He confirms for a 2nd time that he's going to judge Eli and his sons, that both will die in the same day. And of course, and he says for the reason, because, verse 15, because Eli did not rebuke them. Now Samuel, of course, in the morning doesn't want to deliver this message. But Eli forces him to, and as a result, now Samuel, listening to the call, responding to the revelation of the Lord, is confirmed as the prophet. Look at verse 19. Samuel grew and the Lord was with him, and let none of his words fail. All Israel, from Dan even to Beersheba, knew that Samuel was confirmed as a prophet before the Lord. And the Lord appeared again at Shiloh, which is where the tabernacle is, because the Lord revealed himself to Samuel at Shiloh by the word of the Lord. Samuel is now contrasted with Eli. Eli is the seed of the serpent. Samuel is the seed of the woman. He's going to be raised up. Eli is going to be destroyed. We're going to have a new priest. And God is working us towards David. We needed a righteous priest in order to anoint God's king. Samuel listened to the call of God. He responded to revelation. You know, it's the same. We were singing it today. The same love that spread the heavens wide, the same God that was crucified is calling. He's calling us by name. He's calling you to the cross. He's offering that salvation. That is the call that's going out. Paul speaks of this same call. Acts 17, verse 30 and 31. "Therefore, having overlooked the times of ignorance, God is now declaring to men that all people everywhere should repent. Because God has fixed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness through a man whom he has appointed, having furnished proof to all men by raising him from the dead." Or as Hannah would say, "The Lord will judge the ends of the earth, and he will give strength to his king, and he will exalt the horn of his anointed." Have you heard the call and responded? Do you sound the call to others if you've heard it? Have you come to the cross? Blaise Pascal, the philosopher you may be familiar with, mathematician, famous, he heard the call. When he died, they found in his coat pocket his confession sewed in. And it goes like this. "In the year of grace, 1654, Monday, 23rd November, feast of St. Clement, from about 10:30 in the evening until about 12:30, fire. The God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, not of the philosophers and the intellectuals, certitude, feeling, joy, peace. The God of Jesus Christ, my God and your God. Forgetfulness of the world and everything except God. One finds oneself only by way of the directions taught in the gospel. The grandeur of the human soul. Oh, just Father, the world has not known you, but I have known you. Joy, joy, joy. Tears of joy. I have separated myself from him. They have abandoned me, the fountain of living water. My God, will you leave me? May I not be separated from him eternally? This is eternal life, that they may know you, the one true God, and Jesus Christ whom you have sent. Jesus Christ, Jesus Christ, I have separated myself from him. I have run away from him, renounced him, crucified him. May I never be separated from him. One preserves oneself only by way of the lessons taught in the gospel. Renunciation, total and sweet, and so forth. Blaise Pascal heard the call. What about Oscar Wilde? Those of you who may be familiar with him, his biography, he led a wanton life of pleasure. He was imprisoned for suspicion of homosexuality, which he was. He found himself on his deathbed with his male lover at his side, and he prompts the question, all of those little boys that you knew, did you ever love any of them for themselves? His lover confessed, said, you know, I never did. Oscar Wilde said, me neither. And he calls for the priest. And he has a deathbed conversion. We see signs and hints of the Lord's calling to Oscar Wilde as he is in prison. Listen to what he writes. And he of the swollen purple throat and the stark and staring eyes waits for the holy hands that took the thief to paradise. And a broken and contrite heart the Lord will not despise. And with tears of blood, he cleansed the hand that held the steel. For only blood can wipe out blood, and only tears can heal. And the crimson stain that was of Cain became Christ's snow-white seal. Do you think Oscar Wilde got it? He heard it. He heard it loud and clear, and the question is, do we know it, and do we know him?